Hi, this is Roger Boyd of Head East, and you're listening to Iron City Rock.
Hi, y'all. This is Kim Wilson of the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and you are listening to Iron City Rocks with my buddy John. Don't touch that dial.
Hey, this is Warren Haynes of Government Mule, and you're listening to Iron City Rocks.
Episode 572 of the Iron City Rocks podcast. I'm your host, John, coming to you from the Iron City of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, bringing you the best rock, hard rock, heavy metal, and blues talk on the net. Episode 572, very pleased to be welcoming back to the show. For the first time in about 5 years, we have Mr. Warren Haynes on the show. He was last on back in 2021, actually, to talk about the Heavy Load Blues album. We've got him on the show this time. He's going to be coming in to do a couple shows in the area. One coming up very soon in Farmington, Pennsylvania. That's south of the city of Pittsburgh at the magnificent Timber Rock Amphitheater. Government Mule is doing a show with Larkin Poe. They'll be playing that. That's April 17th. And then he's going to be coming around in August to do a co-headlining tour. Government Mule will be with Mr. Joe Bonamassa. So two fantastic chances to see Government Mule this summer if you're a fan in the Western Pennsylvania area. And then joining us in just a little while, a former guitarist of the band Brittany Fox, Tommy Crash, will be on talking about a new album, which is a tribute to the band Brittany Fox with a host of veterans from Brittany Fox performing as well as some other great musicians. So we'll talk to Tommy in just a little bit. But first, we're going to play you a little bit of the most recent Government Mule album, Peace Like a River. Going to be featuring tracks from that when they come into town for sure. So we'll play a little of that to get you in the mood, and we'll talk to Mr. Warren Haynes. Pleasure to welcome back to Iron City Rocks. We have on the line Mr. Warren Haynes, Government Mule. How are you doing today, Warren?
Good.
Well, it is a pleasure to catch up with you again. I think the last time we spoke was prior to you coming in 2023 to do a show at Stage AE. You were doing the Dark Side of the Mule. Got another great album, Peace Like a River, is come out since that. You've got a solo album that came out, but it's been a few years really for both now. Are you guys in the process of putting new music together, or does it even fiscally make sense, you know, for you guys to worry about that, or is touring more, you know, kind of what keeps the wheels on the bus?
Well, yeah, no, we're actually in the process of figuring out what the next record is going to be, if it's going to be a Government Mule record. Since I just did a solo record, I'm guessing it's going that direction. But we're just now in that process. We've been releasing, we released Heavy Load Blues and Peace Like a River back to back, two Government Mule records.
Yeah,
and then I released Million Voices Whisper, my solo record, and then we released a companion piece called The Whisper Sessions, which is like stripped down versions of a lot of the songs from Million Voices Whisper,
mm-hmm.
and just re-released my first solo yeah. record from 1993, Tales of Ordinary Madness, remixed by Jim Scott with a bonus track and remastered. I have a symphonic record coming out that's been in the can for a while that's recorded in my hometown of Asheville, North Carolina, with the Asheville Symphony Orchestra, with O'Teal Burbridge playing yeah. bass, John Medeski playing keyboards, Greg Osby playing saxophone, Jeff Sipe playing drums, my friend Edwin McCain and Jasmine Muhammad singing background. And it's a 2-CD set live retrospective of Allman Brothers songs, Government Mule songs, Grateful Dead songs, songs from my solo records, all interpreted with an orchestra. And it's like a once in a lifetime kind of album. So I've been waiting for the right time to put that out, and it's finally gonna come out as well. And it looks like we're going to re-release the first Government Mule record from 1995 okay. with a complete bonus disc of outtakes of the and unreleased songs from the original trio, myself and Alan Woody and Matt Apps. I'm really, really psyched about that. So there's a lot of music coming
yeah.
down the pipeline right now, and then we're starting to think about what the next studio record will be as well.
Yeah, I think with all that, you may not need to worry about a new one. I mean, just the thought of, you know, as a fan, hearing more from Alan Woody, you know, of all the amazing things you just listed, you know, I just, that's the one that I think kind of made my ears perk up. You know, we lost him so soon, and the band was really, you know, still in, you know, getting its stride at that point, that it's going to be wonderful yeah. to go back and hear those.
A lot of that stuff I had not heard in ages, and was able to kind of sift through the archives and see what was available. And there's a complete disc full of stuff that I'm really, really proud of. You know, some of it's alternate versions of songs from mm-hmm. the first couple of records. Most of it was done for the sessions of the first album. There's, you know, outtakes from a lot of those songs, mm-hmm. but they're complete performances, and the band sounds amazing. Woody sounds incredible. It was great to hear that stuff, and I'm really psyched to put it out there, not just for the hardcore fans, who will love it, but
yeah.
fans in general, I think, you know.
Yeah, I think that certainly, and the symphonic work, you were explaining what all was in that. I'm thinking that had to be a chore to get that down to 2 CDs. I mean, your normal live shows probably are challenging to get to 2 CDs.
Yeah, it was a lot. We recorded two nights in Asheville, and were able to, you know, utilize songs from both nights, and it really turned out fantastic, and Bob Clearmountain mixed it and did a wonderful job, and I'm really psyched for people to hear that, because that's something that is, at that time, I had only played with the symphony a few times, and it was a learning process, you know, a work yeah. in progress, but that was a really pivotal moment where we were starting to get a good handle on it. And, you know, hearing a lot of these songs done that way, I've never been a fan of marrying orchestral music and rock music or jazz or, mm-hmm. or pop music just for the sake of doing it. I've yeah. always felt like it only works on a song by song basis. Mm-hmm. And I picked songs that are very enhanced by the orchestra and don't sound like you're trying to force sure. something that's not meant to be. And I'm really happy with it.
Orrin, when you approach those songs with an orchestra, do you find yourself having to play less? If that's, you know what I mean? I think of somebody like Clapton, who sometimes, you know, does a lot of his interesting stuff kind of in between vocal lines, but with an orchestra, you don't, you know, it could get muddy quick. I imagine if you're doing too much, do you have to kind of change what you do, or you just pepper in their work with what you already do?
Well, you know, a lot of thought went into how do we keep the improvisational spirit as a huge part of this project with the symphony. And so the ways we came up with were there are times when the orchestra will lay out and the band will jam and improv for an undetermined amount of time. Mm-hmm. And then I cue the conductor, and on cue, the orchestra comes back in. There are also times where we're improvising to what the orchestra is playing, which was a real challenge, but I really loved. That was part of the inspiration, was hearing that massive sound of the orchestra behind you and playing on top of that. Yeah, it caused my playing to change a little bit. I don't know if it was less or just different. But it is definitely something you have to consider. The larger the ensemble, the more your role in any situation is going to change. And that held true for O'Teal and for Medeski and mm-hmm. Jeff Seip and Greg Osby as well. But those guys are such seasoned pros. And we all had that same experience of just loving the challenge of bouncing off what the orchestra was doing. And all the songs that we chose for the project were ones that were so unique, the way the band and the orchestra were merged together. And we utilized six or seven different arrangers, each did two or three songs, and we tried to pick the arranger to be the right person for the strength of the song itself. So it was a wonderful experience for me, and singing on top of that is really, really exciting. And you know, I think when people hear some of this stuff, it's different than what you might expect. It's different than mm-hmm. previous projects where people were marrying an orchestra with rock music. I really wanted to approach it in a fresh way, and I think we were able to pull that off.
Do things like this project, and I think of like your Christmas jams, where you know you're more than just the guitarist and the singer. You're ringmaster, a ringleader. In this, does that add stress to this, or is this do you enjoy that kind of doing something outside the norm? Because I mean, imagine a band, you know, Mule is to the point where you could cruise around the country and do shows without tackling projects like these. Do these kind of keep it fresh for you?
Absolutely. Yeah, I love the fact that I'm able to do all these different things. You know, Government Mule is my top priority, but doing solo shows, which there's two different ways to look at that statement. I recently did a tour by myself, solo in the true sense of the word. I did 14 shows where it's just me.
Yeah.
And I've done a handful of shows like that before, but never a tour. And that was a first and really, really exciting. And of course, the Warren Haynes Band, which draws mostly from a different repertoire and catalog, because you know we pull out a few Government Mule show songs, a few Mule songs here and there, but it's mostly stuff from my solo projects and songs that I've written for other artists and interpretations of cover songs. We do a couple of Allman Brothers songs here and there. But I keep those things as separated as possible. So the inspiration for each of them is entirely different, you know. And then, of course, working with different musicians. So when I bounce back and forth from one to the other, it totally keeps me fresh. And that's something I'm extremely thankful for.
Yeah, I could see how, you know, with some bands, and you guys have never, I don't know if you've ever done the same set list twice. But, you know, some bands, you know, it's 15 songs for the entire tour. Sometimes it's 15 songs for the entire decade. I don't want to point fingers at bands. But, you know, some bands don't mix it up. You guys have always had the, you know, the luxury of, you know, being able to go whatever direction you want. You want to do Dark Side of the Moon. You want to do a night of Led Zeppelin songs, you can do that. And I often wondered if those kind of like milestones keep it fascinating for you as a musician. You're a musician's musician in every sense. That sometimes those challenges, I think of someone like Joe, who's often doing the same thing, the show with the Three Kings, for example, just things out of the norm to keep it, the spontaneity up, the interest level up. It's exciting as a fan, though, I will say that. That's
Well,
a
if you're gonna continue to tour at the pace that we all do,
yeah.
there's got to be a constant inspiration and shaking things up and doing things different for you, starting for yourself and for ourselves, but then also for the audience as well, because so many people in our audience come back for multiple shows, even on the same tour. It's not uncommon for me to meet someone who's seen us over 100 times. And so for those people, keeping it different all the time is really important. But even for people who've only seen you a handful of times, I think they appreciate that the show they see this year is not what they saw last year or the year before or next year. And there's something exciting about not knowing what you're going to get. Of course, it goes back to Grateful Dead has been doing that forever. But a lot of blues bands and jazz bands used to do that in the old days as well. And I think back to it, one of the best shows I ever saw was Frank Zappa when I was a senior in high school. And Frank was doing that. I saw him in Atlanta at the Fox Theater in 1978, and I saw the early show, and a friend of mine stuck around and saw the late show as well, and he said he only repeated one song between the two shows. And it just works out good for bands that play improvisational music and where the fans are part of the experience and want to keep coming back and seeing as many shows as possible.
And that's a great way to look at it because, I know of artists that I am a fan of, or I go, okay, I saw them last summer, or I saw the, and I have a pretty good idea. There's been no new material, but with you guys, I've seen that, night to night, you're not doing the same thing. Everybody looks at setlist.fm to see, what they're going to see. You guys could throw that out the window because I, and personally, I love that because it's, you'll be in the middle of a song. And then I remember the first time I saw you guys, a buddy of mine took me to one of your shows and I wasn't real, real familiar. And you guys just went off into the When the Levee Breaks in the middle of the song. And it just blew my mind. It was like, it's just it's a treat for people. And I didn't even know I liked that kind of, improvisational. So it's a treat for the fan, but I assume that that really helps break up the monotony of what could be a very monotonous, tour on the road for the year.
And not only that, I don't think you can judge a show from the set list as well. Especially in bands that improvise to the extent that we do, you can get a glimpse of what it was like from looking at the paper, what it looks like on paper. But there are special nights that can't be described from just the set list. There's something that happens between the band and the audience, and the audience just happens to be amazing. And the venue, everything's falling into place. Even if even some of the songs that we play more than others, sometimes things are just indescribable. But I do think Setlist FM is a great tool to be in looking to see what people did, but you mentioned how you weren't aware that you would be into this kind of thing prior to seeing some of the bands that you've seen. We're also going back to Jimi Hendrix took that approach. they say the first few Cream shows, when Cream was just playing in Europe, their set list was kind of the same every night, and they didn't stretch out to the extent that they eventually would. When they got to San Francisco, Bill Graham wanted them to play a longer show than they were accustomed to. And so they just jammed, and the crowd encouraged it because it was that San Fran crowd, and they're yelling, "Just jam, man." And that changed their approach. Once you realize there's an audience that loves that stuff, it's like in the jazz world, it becomes part of the music.
Yeah. Well, it is a treat for this show, or for this run of shows you're going to be doing. Will you be doing some of the more recent releases, like Peace Like a River, or do you really not have a focus for these and just kind of whatever you feel like that day?
Well, we're doing something from each part of our career, so to speak. And we do a lot from Peace Like a River. For 2 or 3 years, we were doing an extreme amount of that, which was really fun. Mm-hmm. And then once we had kind of hammered that out a lot, we thought, well, let's go back to some of the early records and pull out stuff that we haven't played in a long time. And that's been really cool as well. You know, again, since we might go 4 shows in a row without repeating anything, you never know what you're going to get. I try to make the set list where you get a little bit of everything, mm-hmm. but some nights might be more centered around new stuff. Some might be more centered around old stuff. You never know. The one thing that we want to make a point of is not doing what we did the last time we were
sure.
in a certain town.
Yeah, you know. And that's an awesome thing for the fans. Well, Warren, I want to thank you so much again. You'll be here on the 17th to do a show with Larkin Poe. You'll be back around in August to do a co-headlining tour with Joe Bonamassa in Youngstown. So 2 opportunities to see you, and it looks like plenty of great new material, at least new for us, coming our way in the future. So thank you so much. I wish you all the best, man.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you again.
All right, again, a very special thank you to Warren Haynes of Government Mule. Government Mule will be at the Timber Rock Amphitheater in Farmington, Pennsylvania, to do a show on Friday, April 17th, with Larkin Poe. Going to be a fantastic night. If you have not been to the Timber Rock Amphitheater, cannot speak highly enough of it. Magnificent venue, a beautiful view, really great food there. Dare I say affordable food at a concert. A really, really nice place to see a show. So strongly encourage you to get out there if you're in that area of Western Pennsylvania. And if that's maybe a little too far south for you, maybe you're from the North Hills or up that way, you also can catch Government Mule on August 9th at the Youngstown Foundation Amphitheater. Joe Bonamassa and Government Mule with a co-headlining tour. That's a Sunday night, if I do recall. So 2 chances to see Government Mule. And if you missed Joe Bonamassa, he was just in Pittsburgh to do a show in March. I had a chance to see that. Photos up on Iron City Rocks. Quick plug for that. Joe and Government Mule doing a dual headlining show. Ought to be a magnificent night if you're a guitar freak. That event is for you. So we're going to turn our attention now to a tribute album that caught my attention. From a host of members formerly of the band, Brittany Fox. Brittany Fox, as you know, had several, their self-titled album, Bite Down Hard, really successful, not stratosphere successful, but certainly loved by their fans. The band went through Dean Davison on vocals, and then Tommy Paris, Billy Childs in the band. But this one caught my attention. It's called Kick and Fight, a tribute to Brittany Fox. And this celebrates both the Dean and the Tommy era of the band with a lot of great guests. You've got Tommy Crash, who was a guitarist of Brittany Fox. Henry Now, who's drummer of Brittany Fox. Ronnie Rogers, who was also sang with Brittany Fox. Jamie Fletcher, who had sung with Brittany Fox. Tommy Paris actually performs on this record. Billy Childs, who was the founding guitarist. So there is a bunch of former Britney Fox alum, as well as a lot of other great musicians on this album. So we're going to talk to Tommy Crash of the band about how this kind of came together. Did everybody get in one room and just bang out these songs, or how did it all come together? This album was available very briefly in an extremely limited quantity on physical CD. By the time it even caught my attention, they were already sold out. It is available, though, thankfully, as a digital download for the amazing price of only $9, or it is available on streaming. So you can get it, get your ears on this. So we're going to play you a little taste of Kick and Fight, a tribute to Britney Fox, and then we're going to get into the interview with Tommy Crash. Gentlemen, my pleasure to welcome to the show former guitarist of the band Britney Fox, current project leader, we'll call it, of Kick and Fight, a tribute to Britney Fox. We have Tommy Crash on the line. How you doing, Tommy?
Hey, good. Thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. I was saying off mic there that I tend to find these things just after it's too late. Unfortunately, the physical CD of this was sold out, but you were involved with a Kick and Fight, a tribute to Britney Fox, which was, as a Pennsylvania boy, was always a favorite of mine. Can you talk a little bit about, I know you were in the band for a couple of years, but what kind of got this project off the ground? How did you get these? You've got quite a few, alumni of the band involved with this and a lot of other special guests. So how did this kind of get rolling?
This probably started back in 2005 or 2006. Billy Childs, one of the original I guess one of their founders of the band, or the original bass player, the only bass player they've ever had until recently. But him and I were working together, and we were kicking around doing some acoustic versions of some of the songs, just for fun, kind of. And then I ended up playing with them for a little bit on tour, because Michael, the original guitar player, didn't want to go do the van thing, which is understandable. And I had some of the recordings kicking around that Billy and I did for years and tried to release them in different variations. And Tommy Paris, too, he also sang. I think he sang on a couple of the songs we were working on, too, because the idea was to take an EP and sell it during the little tour we were doing, just to make some extra money. And we, you know, we never got finished with it. So that's kind of how it originated.
And were these, some of these recordings, like you mentioned, Tommy's, I know Tommy sings on some of the ones on this release, were those back from that era, or were these new recordings done for this project particularly?
No, they were back from that era. After we got done the tour, we did a version of Six Guns Loaded, which Tommy sang on and sent me the files. And honestly, I have no idea why we decided to do that. I just know I had the files kicking around for a while. And and I was like, oh, this would be really cool to finish, because, you know, as you and I talked about before, that there's a lot of fans of the Tommy Paris era, and one of myself, you know, myself, I'm a huge fan of his. So I thought it's a different version for people to hear. So I finished it up, and, you know, does it compare to the original? Of course not. Those are pretty flawless in my opinion, but it's something different. And Tommy sang on a couple of the acoustic tracks too, but he never finished. So I think I ended up just putting his background vocals in there, which is kind of a cool little thing to have too.
Yeah, it's really a fun listen. Was it a little bit difficult to get the other vocalists involved? I mean, these are not, the Dean, you know, vocals are not, I imagine, easy. I mean, they're not operatic, so I mean, it's certainly a different kind of singer, but I don't know that there are a lot of vocalists who I think could walk up to the mic. I'm thinking of the singer of Accept might be a great example, but, you know, it's not an enviable task to sing some of those songs.
No, you're right. In fact, I was talking to Michael Kelly Smith. You know, we text back and forth all the time. And I said, you know, I was thinking about doing Louder soon for, like, you know, if we release a vinyl of this and maybe, you know, take some of the tracks off that I might not have loved and do a couple other recordings. And I'm like, I don't even know who I would get to sing that stuff these days. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, Tommy sang so high back then, and Dean's vocals were so unique, and it's very, very difficult to find people to sing Britney Fox stuff well.
Yeah, I know, just from my own life, even when I was 17, 18, trying to sing Long Way to Love, it was a disaster. So, you know, everybody's now in their late 50s, you know, who are probably around during that era. They're not easy songs by any stretch. And he's got, you know, a lot like Tom Kiefer, there's a texture and a tone to his voice that's so distinct that it doesn't make it easy. As far as putting these together, you've got, just looking at the Bandcamp page, you've got Henry, Ronnie, Jamie, Tommy Paris, Billy, all from the original, or, you know, who played in the band at different times. Is the camp relatively friendly? I mean, you mentioned, you know, texting back and forth. Was there a lot of animosity? Obviously, Dean kind of went MIA. From the music industry as a whole, but I mean, it seems like the rest of the guys, you don't hear about lawsuits and things like that the way you do some other bands of that era.
Yeah, I mean, not that I know of. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of money to go around with anyone these days, but I mean, again, this started in 2006, 2007-ish, and we're in, I don't even know how many years ago that was, but some of these guys have played on this at different times. You know, and it's not like I got anyone together in the same room, but
Sure.
You know, yeah, I think everyone's kind of cool. They're all the people I still talk to. They're fine. They're great guys. Nice people.
Yeah. And maybe, like you said, that when you said there's not a lot of money to go around, that might actually, in some respects, help. You know, you hate to, think of it that way. I'm sure everyone would like to be rolling in residuals and publishing and all that stuff. But sometimes that's where the dissension and the backstabbing and all that, the lawyers get involved. Maybe it's just better to have the memories of the music. The songs you chose, I mean, was it just a matter of who you had to play, what you had laying around, or was, did you kind of go through and, here's the must-haves from the list?
Well, I mean, a lot of this is done, fairly brand new within the last couple of years. Only a small part of it mm-hmm. from, what I had around. And I wanted to kind of approach it from more of a 70s vibe or a 70s sound and not quite as polished mm-hmm. as the original recordings, again, because it's dumb to even try to compete with those recordings. They're so great mm-hmm. in my mind. And I didn't necessarily want to do songs that were all the obvious. Of course, from a sales point of view, you had to do Long Way to Love and you had to do Girls School. But other than that, I just wanted to do some that were a little different, or maybe some that, like Lonely Too Long, I really enjoyed playing that live when I had a chance to play with them. And it's a cool song. I mean, to open the CD with that, it's like, it's great. I mean, I love that song. I love that era of the band. It might be my favorite era of the band is the Tommy Parris album. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's got such a cool riff to it. You mentioned from a production standpoint, not competing, but in doing this, the one thing that I notice is it still sounds cohesive. And you're mentioning essentially a 20-year window of recording. Was that a challenge in the mastering to get this all to sound like it came from, you could have told me this was from, a long weekend recording session and I would have known no different. Is that just a testament to how it was recorded back then, or was that a lot of work to try to get that?
Well, I had a guy that I used for a lot of mastering for my stuff. His name is Jack Endino. He's the guy that's in Seattle. He's known for Nirvana Records and Soundgarden. I think he did Soundgarden Records and stuff. Whatever. So he's a good old school music guy, and I had reached out to him because I knew that he's just an old school rock and roll guy, and I didn't want a new, fresh, super compressed mastering because I was trying to, trying to get that 70s sound. But anyway, so Jack mastered it. He's a absolute professional, and it didn't seem like it was a lot of work for him. I mean, I think I only had him do, two masters of a couple songs, but he's great, man.
Knew what he was after, and apparently you fed him everything he needed to be successful at it because it came out great.
Yeah.
Now it's ironic
too that he's a Nirvana, like a grunge guy, and he was mastering a Britney Fox tribute record.
Yeah, I was gonna say might be partially responsible for the fact that everybody's doing this now as a tribute instead of doing a 15th studio album. That's a different story for a different day, I guess. You mentioned the physical CDs. You did a relatively limited run of these that were quickly available and then gone. But you also mentioned the idea of a vinyl. Is this something that it is in the works, or is this just a formality and it's a matter of when?
I would like to do a 10-song vinyl, a limited quantity too. I mean, it's kind of the thing to do now. The more recent vinyl I'm working on is putting my main band Leviathan Project is releasing a vinyl with those guys, and that'll be the first time of doing a vinyl. So I have to see how it works out, because there's supposedly different mastering involved, the cost is higher. Mm-hmm. There could be a lot of things go into it. Again, I think we could probably move 100 copies of a Britney Fox tribute vinyl. So I don't want to do much more than that because I don't want to end up with you know, 97
of
them in my bedroom.
Yeah, well, give me a call. I'd probably take at least 50 of them off your hand. I'd be remiss not to mention Leviathan Project, which has got, you know, I don't want to say a local guy because Tim is from the eastern part of Ohio, very close to Pittsburgh. Tim Ripper Owens, you've got Vinny Appice, among others in the band. Can you talk a little bit about what you guys have going on and plans for the future?
It's always just been a recording project that started at the very beginning of COVID. And, you know, my good friend and partner who works with me on a lot of stuff, Matt Nardo, you know, we started working on it. I wanted to do something that harkened back to like old school metal, borderline some thrash in there. And Tim was obviously, you know, Ripper's always on the road doing something, and he was home because of COVID, and it just worked out really well. And then for the second record, Vinny was available. He had done some stuff with Deco, the record company that puts all this stuff out for me. So
yeah,
they put me in touch, and again, it's that classic metal sound. So I thought Vinny would be, I thought it'd be a cool fit, and to team him up with, you know, Ripper with some classic metal songs.
Yeah,
might be fun. So touring, live shows, I doubt it. I mean, there's not a big demand for something like that. And everyone's got their own, you know, stuff going on, but you never know. But yeah, so the plan is to do a vinyl, which I'm taking, you know, 10 songs from all the recordings we did, kind of the best 10, the most heavy 10. And, you know, probably do a limited edition vinyl. It'd be fun. I'd really like to see that happen.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye out for that. You anticipate that with Deco as well. And then we'll
keep an absolutely. Eye on their I'm talking site to them now about out. That.
Awesome. Well, Tommy, I want to thank you so much. Again, please stay in touch when these come out, because I think that there's maybe a bigger audience than you anticipate for this kind of stuff. So we look forward to these being available. And for now, we'll share links. The Kick and Fight Brittany Fox tribute is available on Bandcamp as a digital download. People can enjoy that. It's also, correct me if I'm wrong, on most of the major streaming services at this point, correct?
Yeah, it just came out streaming March 13th, so it's, you know, you can stream it everywhere, and it's just nice to have it out there. Hopefully someone will find a song or two that they, you know, they like off of it and give it a listen.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, man.
Cool. Thank you very much. I appreciate your interest in this stuff.
All right, Kick and Fight, a tribute to Brittany Fox, is available now. HeavenStreetEntertainment.bandcamp.com. And if you didn't catch all that, head over to IronCityRocks.com and check out the show notes for 572. We'll have links to where you can purchase the download. You can also stream it, but better for the musicians if you pay a couple bucks and help support what these guys are doing. Was a big fan of Brittany Fox. Never had a chance to see them live, but always loved that debut album. It still gets many, many spins in my rotation. Just a great album. And some of the Tommy stuff I honestly never got to hear, and was really, really happy they included some of this in this collection as well. So check that out. Also a reminder, Government Mule will be here on April 17th to do a show with Larkin Poe at the Timber Rock Amphitheater in Farmington, Pennsylvania. You can also catch them at the Youngstown Foundation Amphitheater August 9th if you're willing to take a little bit of a drive outside of Western Pennsylvania. Joe Bonamassa, Government Mule, one night. $59 lawn tickets. Soak that in to see Joe Bonamassa and Government Mule. I can't even fathom how long this show is going to be. I don't know that you'll get quite the full two giant sets of Government Mule. I guess that's still to be determined, but I can't imagine the price per note isn't an incredible value, having those two giants of the guitar, and frankly two great singers. A great night of music that'll be. So two chances to catch Government Mule, and as he said in the interview, some great music. Really, really can't understate the excitement for the re-release of the debut Mule album with the outtakes and such. To hear some Alan Woody music that's new is that's awesome. So want to thank both Tommy and Warren for coming on the show this time, and invite you to check out IronCityRocks.com. We'll have links to tickets for both sets of Mule shows, the Kick and Fight tribute to Brittany Fox. All that will be available on our website, so check that out. You can drop us email, IronCityRocks@gmail.com, if you want to let us know what you thought, if you need more information on something we touched on that you were interested in, if you want to suggest bands, what have you. Love feedback, you know, things you like about the show, things you don't like, more episodes, less episodes, shorter episodes, longer episodes, let us know. Love to hear all that. You can also check us out on all of the social media platforms. It is Iron City Rocks, all one word, no dashes, spaces, underlines, etc. So thank you so much, and until next time, thank you for listening.